The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Pickett is presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. The first case on calendar today is Kiley Ranch Communities versus Branch Banking. And there are three justices assigned to this panel, Justice Seda, as well as Justice Hardesty and myself. Justice Seda is unavoidably absent this morning, but she will listen to the oral arguments and she will participate fully in the deliberations. The oral arguments are available on podcast and she will hear them and it won't cause any delay. Justice Hardesty had a few words he wanted to share with you before we begin.
All right. Thank you, Justice Pickering. I'd like to acknowledge the presence today in the courtroom of representatives or members of the Sierra Nevada Association of Paralegals and participants or members of the Legal Assistance Division of the State Bar. Particularly, I think Susan Sunday is here, if you would stand up, president of SNAP. Welcome. And Melissa Pascal, who is first vice president, who has participated in arranging for the presence of these fine professionals here today. Thank you. Justice Pickering, and for the record and for counsel, these folks will be here throughout all of the oral arguments this morning. And then this afternoon, they will be attending a continuing legal education session in which we will have a vigorous discussion about ethics. Thank you all for being here today.
Very well. Mr. Gunderson, please proceed.
Good morning. May it please this court, counsel, and the esteemed members of the Sierra Nevada Legal Assistance. Mark Gunderson appearing on behalf of Kiley Ranch, ably assisted by Courtney Sweet. In this particular case, it is the position taken by Kiley Ranch that the district court erred in granting summary judgment because of the defendant's admitted facts established clear and unambiguously those items necessary to preclude summary judgment in the bank's favor. What the issue is that's raised here are the effect of and the application of the responses to requests for productions, or excuse me, response for requests for admissions that were admitted by BB&T. Rule 36 of the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure, 36A, is clear and unambiguous on its face. And that rule provides that the failure to respond to requests for admissions within 30 days shall be deemed admissions. It's unique in the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure to not only have a time frame in which acts are to be performed, but a penalty as well. Really not the usual case with other items of written discovery, but in this case, our legislature has said that failure to respond within 30 days will be deemed an admission. The real question that I see that raises itself in this particular case, and that is the efficacy and the viability of written discovery. It is really beyond just requests for admissions, because in this case we had what is unfortunately the all too typical responses to written discovery. In this case, Kiley promulgated interrogatories, requests for admissions, and requests for production of documents, all in a timely manner, all well before the deadline, all of which were unresponded to in a timely fashion by BBTC.
What's the standard of review for a judicial determination that the 30-day time limit's consequence should be avoided? In other words, your opponent asked that he or it be relieved of the admission that followed as a result of not having responded within 30 days to your request. The court didn't expressly rule on that, but their argument is that implicit in the court's ruling was a grant of their request to be relieved from the consequence of letting that time run. What's the standard of review we should apply to that?
The only answer that I can find in the law would be an abuse of discretion standard. That's the usual standard in reviewing orders of district courts. The problem we have here, Justice Pickering, is there was no order. I don't know what you would do in this particular case. Now, I agree that there's this somewhat speculative concept that there was implicit in the court's ruling a grant of their motion to be relieved and a denial of our motion in limine to exclude. But there was no ruling. I don't know what then would be the standard we would apply at the Supreme Court level because there's no ruling. We don't know what Judge Adams was thinking, what he looked at, whether or not he looked at the issues that you need to look at under 36B to be relieved from the default. So the question then becomes, do you just simply say, well, it must have been proper because he didn't actually rule on it? No, I don't think that has to be, that cannot be the standard. And if we take a look at this, because there's not a single word in the order granting summary judgment about this issue, it's just simply silent, ignored. I'm sure it was a troublesome issue for Judge Adams. And I think it was a troublesome issue for him to address because at the stage that this arose, after the close of discovery, within 45 days or less of trial, all of a sudden then we are faced with this issue of how do you handle the responses to the request for admissions. And it goes a little bit beyond that.
How close to the close of discovery were the requests to admit served?
Close of discovery was August 10th. Their responses were received on September 28th.
My question was a little different. How close to the end of discovery were the requests for admission served? Not the responses, but the requests themselves.
Well, they all had to be served in about approximately 90 days prior to trial, give or take.
So the requests for admissions were served towards the end of discovery, correct?
It was towards the end of discovery, well within the deadlines, but about 90 days out. And they were due well before, about 2 or 3 weeks prior to the close of discovery is when they were originally due. The responses didn't come in until about 6 weeks after that and then just a few weeks prior to trial. That's where the issue then comes up of how Kylie been prejudiced. Well, can't conduct discovery. And I'll tell you what gets even more particularly galling about this is that in this particular case, within the time to respond, we received a letter from Banks counsel objecting to the interrogatories. Clearly, they knew they had written discovery that was due. They clearly knew that it was out there, and they clearly knew it was pending, and they clearly knew that they needed to respond within the time period. Their objections to our interrogatories we didn't believe were well-based. We took exception with that and said, file your responses. They didn't do it. They didn't do it in responses to the interrogatories or the request for production or the request for admissions. None of it was done. And I hate to say this because it's all too common. This is what happens. And then when the responses do come in late to all of the discovery, all that we received was objection upon top of objection upon top of objection. So the problem I have in this is these facts are admitted. There's not 1 ounce of good cause to be relieved from their default of failure to respond in a timely fashion. This is a sophisticated firm with sophisticated lawyers that clearly knew because they communicated with us about the the discovery that was due. They just didn't do it. And the excuse is, well, we got busy and distracted. Well, that's not good cause. That's not justifiable excuse for failure to respond.
Would you say that under Rule 52, this court may infer findings that are necessary to support a judgment? And indeed, there's case law that says that we should do that. Should that jurisprudence apply to this setting? And if not, why not? In other words, why shouldn't we imply a finding by Judge Adams that there was good cause to relieve them of the default?
Go to the merits of whether good cause existed. That's really what the issue is. The question really is what was the good cause that's cited by the respondents in this case? They don't have good cause. All they say is that we missed it. We were late. We didn't see it. We forgot. We got hung up with other work. That's not excusable neglect or something that ought to be countenanced. It is so simple in discovery. It isn't that complex. You pick up the telephone. If you're busy, you call the opposing counsel and say, look, I'm jammed, and I need 2 more weeks. No problem. I mean, I practiced law in this jurisdiction for a long time. It happens all the time. Nothing happened. Nothing at all happened in this case. Except there's this argument that they raised that somehow they thought there had been a stay of discovery based on a communication in an email about rescheduling a deposition, which is just absolutely ludicrous on its face. I mean, goodness sakes, we know how to extend discovery and we know how to stay discovery if we want to, and you use the words that say that. It's clearly not implicit. So the question then becomes is when, in this particular case, did they have reason to miss the deadline? No. They really didn't. They just blew it and didn't get it done.
Mr. Gunderson, apart from some of the important procedural issues that you raised today, there are a couple of legal issues that are of concern to me I'd like you and counsel to address. Rule 36 focuses on requests for admission of facts.
Right.
It seems to me that some of the requests for admissions propounded by your office were conclusions of law, not questions of fact. Apart from Rule 36B relief, which was requested by your opponent, can the court disregard admissions, not deem them admitted, if the court views those to be issues of law?
Not.
And the second question, yes. Can the court, in examining a request for admissions and no response, saying, I will only deem admissions relating to facts, not to conclusions of law, if I consider the admission, the request for admission, to request an admitted conclusion of law as opposed to a fact? And then the second question on that point is, in examining 36B relief, following up on Justice Pickering's point, why can't this court infer that the judge rejected these submissions of law?
As to the first question, assuming a timely objection was made to the request for admissions, then you would move to question B. Problem in this case, Your Honor, is that objections are waived if there's no timely response within 30 days.
Rule 36B doesn't require an objection to be made to seek relief. I can seek relief under 36B without having asserted an objection.
The question, though, is being raised is if there's a failure to respond to discovery, do you waive your objections, yes or no? And I believe that you have. Now, if you move to the second part of your question and say, assume that you don't have that evidentiary question that's there, can they now take a look at the request for admissions? The issue that you always have with whether they're interrogatories or requests for admissions it's never clearly just an issue of law or just clearly an issue of fact. We all know that lawyers make these responses, and those responses require often an application of facts to law. And that's what these interrogatories did, or excuse me, these requests for admissions. And I don't think that is an improper way to handle it, because what
Let's examine the request for admissions as they pertain to the set-aside agreement. What requests for admissions were made or propounded to your opponents concerning the set-aside agreement were limited only to questions of fact, as opposed to a request for admission that simply says you breached it?
I didn't hear the first part of your question.
What were the requests for admissions propounded dealing with the set-aside agreement?
Well, we asked, it was a question of whether or not they breached the set-aside agreement or not. I agree.
Isn't that a conclusion of law?
It is.
All right. My question is, what request for admission was propounded that focused on the set-aside agreement that was a request for admission of a fact as opposed to a conclusion of law?
If you look at all of the interrogatories in a whole, there are the predicate questions that were posed or requests for admissions posed that led up to the ultimate question that is in that interrogatory. So they were there in those requests for admissions of fact that there was no that this act didn't breach that agreement, and this act didn't breach the other agreement. So you do get to the ultimate question that you're addressing, but the foundational questions, the requests for admissions, were there in those admissions as well, Your Honor.
Mr. Gunderson, you neglected to reserve any rebuttal time. Do you want to save that, and I'll add a minute to it?
I had asked for a little bit of time, but I see that it's quick. I just asked for 3 minutes, and if I would have that indulgence, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Jeremy Nork on behalf of Respondent Branch Banking and Trust Company. Notably absent from any discussion by appellants at the very commencement of the oral argument was any discussion of the merits of the motion for summary judgment, which is the very procedural posture that brings us here today. We filed for summary judgment. That motion was granted, and here we are. Given the absence of any discussion regarding the merits of that motion, I will therefore focus my presentation on the request for admission. And I'd like to begin focusing on the questions asked by Justice Hardesty regarding request for admissions. The Morgan versus DeMille case, which is a Nevada case in 1990, outlined what is and is not a proper request for admission. And it found that requests for admissions that call for either crucial facts central to the lawsuit or legal conclusions are considered improper. And indeed, that is, with very little exception, almost entirely what the request for admissions were in this particular case. We attached, as a footnote to our brief, examples of requests for admissions that were propounded, and they were simply admit that BB&T breached its contractual agreement, admit that Kylie Ranch did not breach its agreement. And it goes on regarding virtually every agreement that is the subject between the parties.
Let me pause you there for a moment.
Yes.
The text of Rule 36A says you can request admissions concerning not just fact, but also the application of law to fact. Why cannot your opponent find safe harbor in that language?
Well, Your Honor, I think the case law that evaluates that language works to their disadvantage, because the case law in evaluating that language says you can't, as we note in our pleadings, throw a Hail Mary pass in your request for admissions hoping that there is not a response. You can ask for the application of facts, but you cannot ask for the ultimate issue, and that's what the Morgan versus DeMille case talks about. It talks about the procedural statutes. NRCP 36 is to obtain admissions of fact, is to narrow the issues for going to trial.
Was there an objection in the case you're relying on? unlike this case, a timely objection to the
In Morgan versus DeMille, there was a timely objection.
And following up on Justice Hardesty's questions of Mr. Gunderson, does that distinguish this case from that one? In other words, does the absence of a timely objection mean that the request for admission falls on the application of law to fact side of the line automatically because there was no objection that it was, in fact, on the other side of the line?
Your Honor, I would love for that to be the answer. But I struggle with the Smith versus Emery case. The Smith versus Emery case, in dicta, admittedly, addresses this very issue where the court considered and evaluated the Morgan versus DeMille case and said, in that particular case, counsel received requests for admissions. There were numerous requests over the course of time for those requests to be propounded. They were not propounded. A motion was filed to have those requests deemed admitted. There was some legal wrangling going into trial, and then after trial, there was a motion for a new trial or a motion for reconsideration based on the fact that those requests for admissions were not responded to and were not objected to, were improper under the Morgan versus DeMille standard, and therefore they had no obligation to respond. Smith versus Emery disagreed. And
well, if it isn't dicta, it didn't.
Well, it isn't.
It raises the question. We finally get to the point of this oral argument. Should this court revisit the comments made in the Smith case?
I think this court has to, Your Honor, because what is happening today, and I somewhat share Mr. Gunderson's position regarding discovery, only my position is different, which is requests for admissions are being propounded not to narrow the issues, not to make for a more streamlined trial, but rather to try to catch someone in a slip-up. You miss it by a day, and all of a sudden your request for admission was admit that we win and you lose. That's not correct. Smith versus Emery, you're right, it's all dicta, because the court said once a notice of appeal was filed in Smith versus Emery, the court had no jurisdiction to consider motion for reconsideration or motion for no trial or anything after that date, once the notice of appeal was filed. But then the court went on to say, in an effort to kind of address the issue when it came back to the Nevada Supreme Court, was to say, you still had an obligation to object. I think this court is in a position.
Well, from an analytical standpoint, my question, counsel, is this. If Smith holds that one must object and the failure to object bars any relief, how does that square with the provisions of 36B that allows the district court, upon a motion seeking relief, as occurred in this case, to disregard the fact that no objection was made?
It doesn't. It flat doesn't. And that's true of Smith. That's true of Woods versus Label, because in Woods versus Label, it was not a 36B case, or at least 36B was not addressed in the Woods case, but the facts sure are similar to the present case, where a motion was filed to have requests for admissions deemed admitted. The court is silent on that motion, but nevertheless proceeds as if the motion was denied. Nevada Supreme Court at the end of the day says, we're going to determine that the court implicitly denied that motion. Same case here. We are at summary judgment. The motions that were pending before Judge Adams at that time were a motion for summary judgment, a motion in limine to have requests for admissions deemed admitted, and a motion for relief under 36B. Court entered one order, granting summary judgment. I think this court is well within its rights to determine that Judge Adams implicitly denied the motion in limine and granted the 36B motion. And indeed, the facts leading up to the order granting summary judgment absolutely support that conclusion, because there was no mistake in anyone's mind that BB&T was denying the legal conclusions that were being sought in the request for admission. That was obvious in the answer that was filed by BB&T. It was obvious in the pleadings that were filed in opposition to the motion for temporary restraining order. It was obvious at the hearing on the motion for temporary restraining order. It was clear. BB&T very much disputed that it had breached the agreements and rather had taken the contrary position.
Should this court reject the notion that Judge Adams implicitly denied the 36B motion, This was a pretty complicated case. It had lots of agreements, $45 million at stake. At least in the case of the set-aside agreement, there may very well have been questions of fact that would have precluded summary judgment. Shouldn't this court require a district court judge in this context to be more explicit when you've got a case like this in rejecting, rejecting the notion that these admissions should be set aside?
My short answer to that question is yes, it would be very helpful for district courts to be more explicit in their decisions. However, the set-aside agreement was addressed in the order granting summary judgment. Remember, the set-aside agreement, the whole concept there was whether or not Kylie could claim to be a third-party beneficiary to an agreement that was between BB&T and Bellamo Electronics. And the question there was, Bellamo wanted to make sure we wanted to move on to this property. We want to make sure we have access to the property. That was an agreement between BB&T and Bellamo. And sure enough, Bellamo did end up getting access to the property. I think the court addressed that concept, those factual issues and those legal issues, in its order granting summary judgment. With respect to the remainder of 36B, I think the time definitely has come for the court to clarify or at least to reconcile the holdings in Smith and Woods with 36B. 36B entitles a party, and I should point out, the standard in 36B is not good cause. It's not good cause by the moving party. It is whether or not the action, whether or not there's prejudice on the non-moving party, and whether or not the merits of the action will be subserved by granting the motion. And that is absolutely the case here. I don't think that the appellant can argue with a straight face that it is prejudiced by relief under 36B when it knew from day one of this case what BB&T's position was with respect to those ultimate issue requests for admissions.
And what's the exact timeline of the request for admission, the deadline for responding, and then filing of your motion for relief from the deemed admission?
The requests were propounded in June of 2009, the requests were propounded in June. Responses were due in July. In the intervening time, the motion for temporary restraining order was filed on shortened time. At the conclusion of the hearing on the motion for temporary restraining order, and again, I think even counsel for appellant would concede that the primary basis for bringing this lawsuit was to stave off foreclosure. And they lost that motion in the motion for temporary restraining order, and BB&T was allowed to proceed with the foreclosure sale, at least until there was a bankruptcy filing. And so the parties got together at the conclusion of that hearing, after the Judge Adams denied the motion, and we said, what are we going to do in this case? Are we going to proceed? Are we not going to proceed? Are you going to file for bankruptcy? Are you not going to file for bankruptcy? Are we holding off on discovery? What are we doing? And the answer was, I'll get back to you. And yes, they did. They got back to us by filing a motion in limine 7 weeks later.
7 weeks later?
Yes, Your Honor. Within 24 hours of receiving that motion, we filed our responses to requests for admissions. We filed a motion for relief under 36B. We filed our motion for summary judgment.
What argument for prejudice did they make to the district court to satisfy 36B opposing your motion to be relieved from the admissions?
The argument that was made in the opposition to our motion for relief under 36B was that it would affect their trial strategy. And I guess it would, because then they would have to call witnesses, because apparently their trial strategy would have been, based on the admitted request for admission, just here are the requests for admissions, we win. I don't think Judge Adams held that in very high regard, that claim to prejudice.
Could you sort of make your case for that it would be an abuse of discretion for Judge Adams to have denied your request for relief from the...
Absolutely. The flip side, Your Honor?
Yes.
Absolutely. And that you point to 36B in order to find that. The question, the standard of 36B, if the court will recall, is whether or not the merits of the case will be subserved. And the merits of the case would absolutely be subserved because there would be no merits to try. These were ultimate issue requests for admissions that admitted the ultimate final issue of the case. There would have been no opportunity to have this case heard on the merits because there would have been no need to. That would be the basis. It would have been a clear abuse of discretion had the opposite occurred, had Judge Adams denied it.
Well, wouldn't Kylie Ranch be a prejudice to a degree in opposing the summary judgment motion? It's relying on the request for admissions, which are deemed admitted. It didn't go out and get this additional discovery. It didn't get affidavits and depots and the like because it had requested the admissions, treated them as deemed admitted, and opposed the summary judgment motion on that basis. So wouldn't they be prejudiced if the judge makes a decision, which he didn't state in his order, that I'm going to now treat all these facts as I'm going to set aside these admissions?
I think, Your Honor, that...
How is Kylie Ranch supposed to oppose the summary judgment motion if it doesn't have the discovery to do so?
Well, Your Honor, the summary judgment motion was founded on the notion that Kylie Ranch had failed to pay their loan when it was due, $41 million when it was due in July. They could have proffered any kind of affidavit from any representative of the Kylies to argue that, no, they weren't in default when it was due.
But it was perfectly reasonable for them to rely on the admissions, which said, at least unadmitted, you breached the agreement, and therefore they weren't liable.
I think, Your Honor, to rely upon those admissions would be to litigate with one's head in the sand, because leading up to that point, again, we had affidavits in support of our opposition to the motion for temporary restraining order. We had denied it in the answer. We had argued it at the motion for temporary restraining order. It was abundantly clear that they were taking a huge risk if they were to solely rely upon requests for admissions that had been deemed admitted, particularly, Your Honor, in light of the fact that a 36B motion was pending at the time. Very risky move, and I think it backfired on them, Your Honor.
Well, but they had opposed the 36B motion, right?
Yes, they did.
Okay. I guess this is an example of a situation where the district judge really should resolve that 36B motion in its order.
As this court is well aware, we did file a motion both in the Nevada Supreme Court and the district court for that very thing. We just wanted clarification. What is the court's position on the 36B motion? Now, I think Woods, Your Honor, allows this court, and Rule 52 allows this court, to consider Judge Adams to have implicitly granted that motion. But yes, my presentation would have been shorter had the court explicitly granted our motion. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. 3 minutes.
Mr. Gunderson, what was your response to the summary judgment motion by way of affidavit or discovery? I mean, were you relying on the admissions that you thought had been admitted?
Yes, absolutely.
So because they were admitted, you wouldn't pursue other discovery alternatives or affidavits to oppose the summary judgment
absolutely.
Motion?
Absolutely. And bear in mind, I was trying to point this out earlier, is that we had interrogatories to which we got no responses, got objections. You know, had we not had the admissions, we would have brought up those issues on the interrogatories because they didn't get responded to either. So we had no discovery. We relied on these admissions, and I think we had every right to rely upon these admissions because those are admitted under the statute the way it operates. The real question is did the judge have grounds under 36B to grant relief? And I will say that without doubt, in the second part of 36B, the lack of prejudice to Kylie can't make that finding. Clearly, Kylie is prejudiced because the close of discovery had then occurred. This all happens post-close of discovery.
What showing, though, did you make in support of your argument for prejudice that you had anything to offer in the way of evidence or facts or law that would defeat summary judgment, assuming the admissions were set aside? I mean, was there a basis in truth and in fact to oppose summary judgment other than the request for admissions having been deemed admitted?
Yes.
And what showing did you make of that?
We made that showing by saying our position was from the very beginning of this case, which, by the way, we filed, was Kylie, when there were executory items to be done by the bank, was not in breach, but the bank breached before Kylie. And that's where this issue arose. We said we weren't in breach. We were, in fact, performing. And by the way, this is a course of conduct. When Colonial Bank had this note, this was a rolling note with construction and renewals, and this had gone on for any number of a number of years, so we had a course of dealing. We were in the process of negotiating this and going forward. There were executory requirements. The bank had to fund construction and ongoing items and the Belimo deal and a bunch of other things like that, and we said we'll prevail on those issues. So those are factual issues that we raised. Had we have had the time to do the discovery and had we had the time to do that, we would have had a different opposition, but we would have fleshed that out more completely because obviously we were still reliant on those requests for admissions. And so the question really is who bears the brunt of the failure? And that is the party who performed or was the cause of that failure, not Kylie's, not Kylie's responsibility.
Thank you. Opposing the summary judgment motion, did you make a 56F request for extension of time to conduct discovery?
We did. Thank you, Your Honors.
Would you provide to the clerk the record site of that portion of the opposition to the summary judgment where that request was made?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.